The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, as we said last week, I'm really looking forward to this interview. Steve Forbes has been in the political realm, but he's also been in the business realm. And these are the two areas that I think people are asking the questions of right now.
Well, for decades, and in fact, intergenerationally, there's been this concept of continuing to give education and guidance and be a conservative voice through Forbes magazine. And
right.
So, yeah, Steve has made a considerable contribution. And I think whether it is, you know, sponsoring the notion of a flat tax, which, you know, obviously is an amazing concept. When you contrast the road of redistribution that we're heading down now, it's incredibly sensible and incredibly simple, just what we need. That's not on the table. That's not going to be considered. That won't be a part of the grand bargain. But we would like to include Steve in the conversation because, again, combining those political themes with policy-related issues directly tied to the economy and the financial structure, this is where we're at. This is where we're going. There's major transitions ahead, and I think having as much insight on that today is vital.
Well, and he's been a prominent voice, Dave, in his magazine and in other publications on a return to the gold standard, a steady currency, steady state where we know actually what it's worth on a daily basis.
At Freedom Fest, I've been on the speaking platform with Steve a number of times, and that's something that he's taken an interest in because it is related to the ideas which has made this country great. What are the ideas that make this country great? Let's talk about them. Let's understand them. Let's put them into action. He has much more of a deep-seated conviction and commitment to the greatness of this country, and I think that goes understated a lot in his letter, but should be appreciated by all of us. Steve Forbes, thanks for joining us today. Let's talk about a compromise that Democrats could say yes to. You've got rising rates, which, taking us back to the Clinton era levels, is one side of the equation. What else needs to be done here? We've got revenues. If they were to equal expenditures, they're off the charts compared to where we were back in the Clinton era. Maybe you can talk to what a real balanced approach would be to the fiscal cliff and any sort of agreement you think could be penciled out.
Well, unfortunately, I think given the ideologies involved, any agreement made now, especially in the haste before year-end, is going to do more harm than good. The best thing they could do is put it off, put everything off for 6 or 12 months so these things can be approached in a constructive manner instead of trying to do it in haste during the holidays before Christmas. The Clinton era had higher tax rates than today. But the Clinton era also had things that were conducive to economic growth that the Democrats won't go along with. One is there was no Obamacare. Hillary Care then had been rejected by Congress, so you didn't have that huge regulatory and fiscal burden coming on the economy. You had spending that was proportionately about $500 billion less than it is today. I don't think too many Democrats are going to go along with those kinds of reductions. You had a dollar that was very stable, almost as good as gold back in the mid-90s. You're not going to get that from the current Federal Reserve. And you had a much more benign regulatory environment on the financial side and on the EPA side than you do today. So if you want Clinton-like tax rates, Democrats must understand that you had other facets of that era that made economic progress possible.
So all things equal, you'd have to eliminate Obamacare. You'd have to reduce spending by better than 14%, and you'd have to put a leash on Ben Bernanke. I mean, is that really what you're saying? Is to have all things equal, it's kind of a far cry from reality.
That's right. So for tax advocates, tax increase advocates, to say that, they worked in the Clinton era, well, you have to take the whole thing. You just can't cherry pick pieces that you like and leave out the rest that made that era possible. And what we have today is a great opportunity to drastically simplify the code, reduce tax rates. That was done in 1986, bipartisan. The Democrats did not like tax shelters, so the code, they got rid of almost all the tax shelters in the code. At the same time, they simplified the tax rate structure, brought it down to two rates, and cut the top income tax rate from 50% down to 28%. They could do something in a similar manner today, But I don't think that's in the cards right now. So I think you're going to see some very hard bargaining. And I think to think that we can get something constructive done in a few days is delusional and going to do the economy real harm. You look at Western Europe, you look at Japan, they're all substantially raising taxes, driving those economies into recession. Japan's already in a recession. Germany's about to go in one. France will go into one next year when their tax increases really kick in. And so the United States should be very careful before going down that path, because we're the only game left in town.
Can we avoid a recession next year?
I think we can, but if we do something quick in terms of a tax increase now, the answer is we will have a slowdown. The Federal Reserve is continuing to create an environment that is very hostile for credit, reliable flow of credit to small and medium-sized businesses. The spending shows no signs of real restraint, and taxes are an uncertainty, and you've got an avalanche of regulations coming on health care and finance. And the EPA has indicated recently they're going to get revved up to put numerous new regulations on the energy industry. So it's not a pretty picture. It's avoidable, but they don't seem willing to avoid it.
Now, you mentioned low rates and the Federal Reserve's activity right now. The zero interest rate policy has essentially created a layer of price controls in the financial market, manipulating yes. rates lower, bond prices higher. Look at a few years. Prognosticate as to the consequences of those kinds of price controls?
Well, what they've done already is badly distorted the credit markets. If you can't get a realistic price of a product or service, you get less availability of that product or service. We should have learned that from price controls going back to the Roman Empire, when they tried that with some disastrous results. So what you have today is the government has deficits without tiers, because it costs virtually nothing for the government to run huge deficits. The Federal Reserve is willing to buy most of the debt. And what that means, though, is that since you can't get a reliable price for credit, small and medium-sized businesses are in a very tough environment. Bank lending has gone down in the last 3 months. And business investment has stalled, which is not good for the future. So looking out, at some point, the Federal Reserve is going to have to face up to its disastrous policies. Let interest rates be set by the market, not by manipulative politicians, and let the capital be created again and capital invested again. Right now, if you're a saver, you're being punished, which hurts particularly older people who rely on bank CDs and normal interest rates for income. They're getting hurt. And the economy's getting hurt because you're not getting investment and you're not getting capital creation.
Well, you know, on that issue of debt, we continue to see it ratchet higher. Number one, from a policy standpoint, what's the right course of action? And number two, on the assumption that there will be errors in implementation of those policies, what should individuals be doing? Frustration, you described by the saver. How do we respond?
Well, I think depending on, obviously, where you are in life, if you're about to retire, obviously, you need to have some cash around. But if you are not near retirement and you don't have any big immediate expenses on the horizon, then the best thing to do, which sounds counterintuitive, is to ride the storm out. The biggest enemy of investors is emotions, which is why individuals always, as a group, underperform the market. And a lot of institutions as well, because human nature being what it is, when times are good, you pile into the market. When times are bad, you go on the sidelines. And so you get whipsawed. No one can time the market consistently. And then Warren Buffett will tell you that. So what individuals do is, you know, after the horrors of 2008, early 2009, when the market went through a terrible bear market, a lot of individuals pulled out. They're still out today. But what happened in March of 2009, when people thought the world was coming to an end, was that there were some changes, regulatory changes on bank capital that got virtually no notice early March. The market turned around and is today about twice what it was in 2009. How many individuals who got hurt by the market were able to benefit from that doubling? A lot of them missed it. So if you don't have immediate needs for cash, then ride the storm through. If you can do so, put a certain amount aside. It doesn't matter how much, but do it consistently, whether it's weekly, quarterly, monthly, whatever. And you'll do well over time. Dollar cost averaging will help you. But if you let emotions control your investment actions, you're going to end up getting hurt. So save, invest, and ride the market. Eventually, it will turn, even when it looks bleakest.
Steve, the last time we talked with John Taylor, he suggested that rates are too low by at least one percentage point. You know, doesn't that sort of frustrating set of circumstances increase systemic risk as investors are more or less forced to higher yielding assets? Not forced, but they choose to go there seeking to make ends meet. And again, as you say, ride the storm out, but it does appear that there's been a major push towards higher risk assets to compensate for a lack of real rates of return.
Well, that's where investors, they're still going into bonds, bond funds, I should say. And that is not the place to be right now, because even though bonds have done relatively well because of what the Federal Reserve has done, that is a bubble and an artificial bubble created by the government. And those things do not last forever. So this is not the time to be buying bonds. If you want, you can go into stocks that have dividends, a good record of dividends. That is, you want profitable companies that pay a nice dividend, 2, 3, 4%, because at least they can be nimble enough to survive whatever destructive policies come out of Washington. And in the meantime, they give you some money. But again, don't let daily stock prices influence you on this. You can get some yield, but don't go into high yield funds just because they have a yield that looks high by today's standards. We know historically those yields stink.
You know, looking at an article you wrote a few months back, if you see gold playing a part in our monetary system in the future, is it fair to assume that it has a place in an individual portfolio? To what degree, again, looking at Ben Bernanke's penchant to monetize paper assets with more money, does that kind of drive the issue?
Yes, and eventually, and I think within a few years it'll happen, eventually we are going to have the dollar relinked to gold. All that means is that the dollar will have a steady value, like 60 minutes in an hour. Or when you go to the supermarket, you buy a pound of hamburger, you assume it's 16 ounces, not 13, not 10, not 20. It doesn't float each day. It's a fixed measure, and stable money is always a necessity for long-term prosperity, sustainable prosperity. But that lesson, even though we've had 4,000 years of experience, is absolutely lost on today's crop of central bankers and economists, and it's very, very destructive. Right now, this country is consuming, thanks to Washington, more wealth than it is creating. The government gets all it wants, when we know government does not create wealth, and wealth creators, entrepreneurs, job creators, they're pushed on the sidelines. Not a good thing.
Maybe you've seen Lewis Lehrman's piece on establishing the gold standard and kind of a workbook, if you will, towards that end. What probability do you see of that occurring? And is there sort of a precipitating event or a set of circumstances where the general public says, this is what we want? As you said, a fixed measure.
I think Lou Lehrman is right that eventually we will get a gold standard, and you ask the right question. Is it going to be precipitated by crisis, or more happily, will it be done by a new set of policymakers who realize that's the way to go, and we don't have to go through some horrific crisis that would be even worse than 2008 to do something we should have never undone in the 1970s. As you know, the U.S. dollar, one way or the other, it was linked for gold for most of its first 180 years of this country's existence. But since the 70s, that's not been the case, and we've had these ever more destructive financial and currency and banking crises. So I would hope that after this president leaves office and we get a new Federal Reserve chairman, we will move to a genuine monetary stability and not have to go through some disaster to wake up our ever-ignorant policymakers in Washington.
Yeah, and you know, easy money policies continue to feed sort of the federal leviathan. Is it going to be a GOP-driven initiative? Is this something we have to wait till 2014, 2016? Can you even speculate as to what a time frame would be?
Well, I would hope within, and I think events will push this in the next 5 years. There's growing interest in gold, not as an investment, but as a base for a new monetary system. A number of Republicans, a number of people in the Tea Party recognize instinctively that a weak dollar is not good for the country, not good for prosperity. So I think the tide is beginning to turn, and which was not the case when Ronald Reagan came into office. Even though we'd had a terrible inflation in the 1970s, there was virtually no understanding of a gold-based system. Lou Lehrman at the time, Ron Paul at the time, and still today, but they were a very, very distinct minority. But there's growing interest. We're not there yet in terms of anywhere near a consensus for gold, but you see the stirrings. A number of Republican members of the House are interested in it. And smart Democrats who see beyond this disastrous administration should embrace it, because they're going to need something to go to the voters when this economy continues to perform in a miserable manner.
You look at the old Summers-Barsky thesis, and it argued that zero or even low real rates of return drive investor component, that demand for gold. How do we square that with the Fed's renewed commitment to keep rates low through 2015, early 2016? Even if Bernanke leaves, you've got Janet Yellen, you've got a number of people sort of waiting in the wings that have affirmed this notion of zero rates as far as the eye can see.
Yeah, well, that's why I think when you get a change at the Fed, it's going to be just more than the chairman. It's going to be a mandate from Congress and from the White House and the Treasury Department. We're not going to continue with this destructive nonsense. Ben Bernanke is a living example of insanity. As we know, one definition of insanity is you keep doing something that doesn't work and hope that next time it will. And so this perpetual QE policy, I think we're about number 10 coming up, is manifestly not working. It's like doctors 150 years ago who'd bleed their patients and the patient would die, but they would continue to bleed the patients.
You know, in the past, over-indebtedness has been addressed by defaulting, but typically that's when the debt was denominated in a foreign currency, or by printing, the second alternative. And, you know, that may be just a subtle form of default, which is quite effective if you can get away with it. Of course, it has nasty side effects. But there's also this issue of financial repression. We have that, what we've been talking about, with zero interest rates. And do you see our foreign creditors playing along with this sort of abuse of privilege? On the one hand, we're printing more money than we should be. On the other hand, we've got rates repressed, which basically acts as a subsidy to Treasury debt. It's a redirection of capital which would have gone to the consumer or the saver, and instead is going as a subsidy to government. How long do creditors say, we'll go along, we'll play along, or do they just wash their hands, and why?
It's impossible to know what the scenario will be that will bring this to an end, other than new policymakers coming in, because we've never done something like this before, where we have the chief central bank of the world just gouging itself on long-term debt. I mean, traditionally, the Fed always buys short-term debt, and now they're gobbling up all long-term bonds, gobbling up mortgage-backed securities. This we've never seen before. And in terms of people still buying U.S. government bonds, it's more out of because what is the alternative than because they really like it. You look around the world, all currencies have been debased. It's just a matter of degree. So you may be a 98-pound weakling, but if the competitor is an 88-pound weakling, you'll look relatively strong. You're not going to win the Olympics, but it's what's the least junky thing out there? And U.S. capital markets are still the deepest in the world. That won't remain forever if we continue this nonsense. But because we do have huge capital markets, people are willing to buy our paper because they know there's liquidity and they can move in and out. So, which you don't get with bonds denominated in euros or pounds or yen. So it's by default that people are buying this stuff, not because they really think it's of long-term value.
Steve, we've talked some about policies, we've talked some about technical market issues, and you have a lot of wisdom, a lot of time in the business, not only publishing, but the markets. And we're very interested in your perspective, concerns. When you look at the next generation, how do we honor them with our actions today?
By leaving them with a set of principles and policies that reflect what made this country unique in the first place. And one of those principles is sound money, an environment where people can do things to, as Abraham Lincoln put it, improve their lot in life. And right now, we're creating an environment where stagnation is going to be the norm, not progress. And I think it's not a new normal. I think it's a new abnormal, and it's not going to last. Obama doesn't realize it, but the worst thing that happened to him was his reelection, because by the time his second term ends, it's going to be, unfortunately, fearfully clear even to his supporters that his experiment in socialism was an abject failure.
So that really does get to that issue of Maggie Thatcher saying the game is up when you've run out of other people's money.
Yeah, and printing money is not real money.
Well, thank you for joining us. We enjoy the conversation and look forward to having you back.
Terrific. Thank you.
Well, David, as promised, that was a fascinating interview. I think it's fascinating, too, that he sees the problem as policymakers. This is not going to get done without new policymakers, even at the Federal Reserve. He's not seeing just a change in Federal Reserve chairman. He's talking about a change of the whole thing.
Well, and that mandate from above, that will require, I think, a new stock of people in D.C. with a new set of eyes on the problem. Now, we had a number of things in the past which have done that, but again, it was a new set of policymakers. When you look at what happened in the transition 1979 to 1980 here in the United States. It was Paul Volcker coming in and then supported by a presidential administration. That worked. That worked. We had the same thing across the pond with Maggie Thatcher. Of course, they tapped into the North Sea oil in 79, and that was sort of a financial tailwind, if you will, for policy implementation. Maybe it is a combination of energy reforms in the United States and new policymakers. You know, again, this may be 2016 before we get to it, but I think we need to know what the game plan is and how to press the advantage when the opportunity is given.
Well, and I think we can take courage, Dave, like we talked about last week, that the new normal, what we thought the new normal was, which was redistribution and socialism, is actually the new abnormal. And he said, you know, probably the worst thing for socialism and Obama's policies was the reelection of Obama, because we're going to get to test it. We're going to get to see the ramifications and the consequences.
But the best thing for the country is that socialism and this experience, this boondoggle of an experience, gets to be tested, tried in the public square, and hopefully voted out for many generations.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney, and our guest today, Steve Forbes. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.